WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN-sponsored talks in Bonn, Germany, have brought together several Afghan factions to arrange for a post-Taliban government. They're working out a plan for a national council that would function as a temporary legislature and provide some stability until long-term plans for a new government are agreed on. My guest, Larry Goodson, is the author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. He writes about the collapse of communism in Afghanistan, the failures of the warlords who took over, the rise of the Taliban, and the ongoing conflicts between ethnic groups. Goodson is an associate professor of international studies at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts. I asked him to tell us more about the goals of the current talks in Bonn.
The goals of the current talks in Bonn are to produce a broad-based government in Afghanistan that will represent the different groups there, the different ethnic groups and the different factions that have come into being over the last 20-odd years of war in Afghanistan, and produce a government, a transitional government. I know that no one thinks it will be the permanent solution, but a transitional government that can go into Kabul and that the UN can then say, okay, this is an Afghan government, and if they invite us to do this or that with regard to reconstruction or peacekeeping or whatever, we will respond to that because they are the transitional government. And then that government would be the government that would put in place a process that would produce a new constitution and move towards a more permanent government for the country.
What are the obstacles that everyone getting together in Bonn faces now in terms of putting together a transitional government that will actually function?
Well, I would say that there are several obstacles. The UN doesn't have a very good track record in Afghanistan of producing anything political, I mean, such as a ceasefire of any meaningful length or a broad-based government in the past. So the UN doesn't have a lot of there's not a lot of confidence in this process on the part of your average Afghan or on the part of these various warlords. You'll notice if you look at the list of delegates that none of the major players have gone for the most part to Bonn. All the warlords have sent someone further down their chain of command to sort of represent them, which means that everyone will have to check, with the Home Office before they can agree to anything. So that's one problem. The other probably bigger problem is that in the absence of a sort of muscular peacekeeping force from outside, there won't be much real leverage on the warlords, the different factions who have heavy weapons and armed forces. There won't be much leverage to get them to go along with anything that they're not comfortable with. So if they feel that they didn't get enough seats at the table, or if they didn't get the ministry that they think they should have, or whatever, what leverage will there be to get them to participate?
Is it possible that the representatives of the warlords will agree on some kind of transitional government, and then when the meetings are over, that things will fall apart again and the warlords will take over their territories and try to rule them and we'll see more fighting between them again? Do you think that that's a possible scenario?
I'd say it's actually a likely scenario that we will see a revisiting of the early 1990s when Afghanistan was a patchwork of warlord-controlled territories, some of them ruled quite well, reasonably well, and other places where there was widespread anarchy and lawlessness and a real fragmentation of the country. And I think that in the absence, again, of a strong peacekeeping force and a really dynamic role for the Western powers to sort of lead this process, that we're likely to see that again in Afghanistan.
And are many of the warlords who controlled territory before the Taliban, the same people who were fighting the Taliban and who are now taking over territories again?
Yes, we have seen a return of a lot of these warlords who had been either driven into exile by the rise of the Taliban or, in the case of the Northern Alliance, driven into virtual exile, driven into the far northeastern mountainous corner of the country. And also quite a few guys who sort of joined with the Taliban when the Taliban were in ascendance, who have now switched sides and are reclaiming control of their original territory. Well, not even reclaiming it. They had control of those territories under the Taliban. So now it's a simple matter of switching sides and saying, I'm not with the Taliban any longer, and I still control whatever my particular area of the country is. So yeah, right now there's 20, 25, it's hard to say exactly, different groups, many of them headed by older players who've been in exile, once again controlling a patch of the Afghan countryside.
Is this a pattern in Afghanistan of people changing sides depending on which side is winning and which side they think will personally benefit them?
It is a historical pattern that we see all the time in Afghanistan. It grows out of the inherent localism of the country and the fact that identity in Afghanistan is very much at the local or what is called the Qaum level. And that refers, it's essentially an Arabic word that refers to localized identity formations. And in Afghanistan, what this means in terms of fighting is that when you look at a group like the Taliban or the Northern Alliance and you try to understand it, you say, okay, here's the Northern Alliance. They have four major factions, or maybe you have a greater understanding and you talk about eight factions because you know that within the Hazara, for example, there are three major sub-factions. But a more correct way to understand it is that really you've got hundreds of small, localized, Qaum-based groups of guys who have gotten together with their brothers and their cousins and a few guys from the village that they're all kind of connected or from their valley or from their neighborhood or whatever, and they fight together as a sort of localized militia. And they give their loyalty, or rather maybe they rent their loyalty, although I don't want to imply that it's always up for sale, but they tend to give their loyalty to a larger group whose commander can supply them with weapons and who leads them in the way that they think is appropriate. And they can withdraw that whenever they feel they need to. So there's a lot of chatter across walkie-talkies in Afghanistan between opposition commanders, you know, across the battlefield who know each other, and who from time to time fight on the same side and from time to time fight on the other side. And it's probably important to keep that in mind, even if it's too complex for the average American to really learn all those local groups.
So what kind of problem does that pose, say, for the United States now, the fact that there are a lot of people who are probably switching sides, a lot of Taliban who are probably crossing over to the other side?
Well, it does present a problem insofar as we don't have the depth of knowledge of Afghanistan that we need to have. This has been an area that the U.S. government has not paid much attention to in terms of our intelligence gathering or our intelligence analysis over the last decade or so. And consequently, we don't really know who all these guys are, and we don't know exactly what their relationship with each other, what those relationships are. And so we don't have a good sense of how to, as it were, manipulate the process so that it will produce in the end a stable situation. And I think the talks in Bonn are case in point. I mean, we're sort of putting great stock in this process when it is almost certainly not going to produce anything that is widely acceptable to the Afghans, especially those Pashtuns who for the last few years have been governed by the Taliban and for the most part willing to go along with that since the Taliban were Pashtuns. who now, because they were affiliated with the Taliban, are not being really represented in these talks and therefore are likely to get a temporary transitional government that they are going to view correctly as a government dominated by the Northern Alliance and exile groups, and therefore not a government that they will be pleased with.
My guest is Larry Goodson. He's the author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Goodson. He's the author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. You describe Afghanistan as the archetype of a failed state. What do you mean?
Well, my contention is that all of these problems that we have now been affected by in the form of the terrorist attacks on the United States, but that also prior to this, the broader region right around Afghanistan had been affected by more directly, such as the drug trafficking and arms smuggling and the spread of Islamic militancy, that all of that grows out of the fact that Afghanistan has suffered from profound state failure. By that I mean that the governing institutions in Afghanistan had basically ceased to function, both during the Taliban period, when the Taliban were not a very successful governing force, except insofar as sort of social policy towards women and that sort of thing. And prior to that, during this warlord period that we were just talking about a few moments ago, in both of those circumstances, the long war in Afghanistan that did so much destruction to the physical infrastructure and to the political and economic institutions had created circumstances where the local forces have become resurgent and preeminent once again, and the government, in effect, the central government, ceased to exist. And in that situation of state failure, as some of my fellow political scientists call that, Afghanistan became a place that could be a haven to people like Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda organization, a haven to the world's largest heroin smugglers, to this large regional arms smuggling and duty-free goods smuggling network, and the spread of Islamic militancy in the region.
The Bush administration has indicated that it's unlikely that the U.S. would be part of a formal peacekeeping or peacemaking force after they're done dealing with bin Laden and al-Qaeda. What are some of the pros and cons of continued U.S. involvement in Afghanistan?
The major pros are that it would give us an opportunity to rebuild the physical destruction of Afghanistan that has itself allowed all of these ills, the terrorism, the criminal activity, the Islamic militancy to come out of Afghanistan. If we don't address that, then Afghanistan will continue to be a big problem for the world in the foreseeable future and a problem for the United States. I think the cons are the fears that that U.S. forces would get dragged into a sort of civil war and would become targeted. We might see a revisiting of the Somalia situation where U.S. forces are killed and dragged through the streets and this sort of thing. I think those fears are way overblown. I think there's a real hunger in Afghanistan for, in fact, I know from my own interviews there and my recent efforts to gather information from long distance through the Afghan community that that there's a real hunger for U.S. leadership and U.S. on the ground. In fact, the Afghans view it as really the only solution. The common Afghan, the political leaders that currently control Kabul are telling us a different story. No, we can do this ourselves. But the common Afghans know that the average Afghan knows that there has to be an international force in Afghanistan to make all of this happen, or we will see a degeneration into civil war and warlordism again.
Let me quote something that Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has said. He said, one lesson of Afghanistan that we have seen in the past is alliances shift from month to month and year to year. And the one thing that seems to unite Afghans over long periods of time is that they don't much like foreigners. And that's part of the argument against the United States remaining in Afghanistan and overseeing a new government or, you know, participating in a peacekeeping force.
Correct. That is the case in Afghan history, but it is a misapplication of a historical lesson to a current situation, with all due respect to Mr. Wolfowitz. I would argue that there's really sort of two points to this, one that has to do with Afghanistan and another that has to do with the broader effort that the U.S. has embarked on, this so-called war on terrorism that we've, you know, heard so much about. In the first instance, I think this fails to recognize the profundity and comprehensiveness of the destruction that has been wrought in Afghanistan over the last almost quarter century of war. And that you really have to look at that and say, okay, here's a country that is now basically destroyed. Most of the people who are non-combatants are completely tired of war. There has been widespread destruction. Virtually every physical structure in the country has been hit by weapons of one sort or another. The cities in many places have been reduced to rubble. Most of the population has been dispersed or wounded or killed by the war. Or if they're younger, they've grown up in circumstances where they've only known war. Mines all over the countryside. I mean, we could go on and on. But this, the level and the depth of this destruction is such that at the moment, the Afghans are looking for a way to rebuild themselves. And I think there is a window where foreign powers that wish to help Afghanistan, not either to advance some neo-colonial project, nor to occupy the country, but to come in and provide immediate relief for the people on the verge of starvation and more longer-term physical reconstruction of the infrastructure that's been destroyed in helping the people reestablish an economy. All of those things, things that I would think the United States could actually do quite well, those sorts of things the Afghan people would be completely willing to receive, at least in the short run. The other point I wanted to make, and I'll make this one more briefly, is just that if we're going to have a war on terror, we have to keep in mind that the terrorists that attack the United States, at least as best we understand it, come from this Al-Qaeda organization, and they're virtually all Arabs, and they come from this youthful segment of the Arab population. Some 45% of the population in the Middle East is under the age of the average American college student. So you've got this large segment of sort of disenfranchised and disenchanted youth that many of whom have great animosity toward the West. And I think if the U.S. policy is to say, well, we'll bomb Afghanistan and then we'll go in and get bin Laden and Mullah Omar and the other leaders and we'll kill them, and then having done that, we'll sort of step back and hope that Lakhdar Brahimi and the UN can actually foster something that will work, knowing full well that it won't for the reasons that we've been talking about already. If that's our policy, then I think we'll be sending the wrong signal to those young people in the Middle East who have been so receptive to bin Laden's message of anti-Western hatred and animosity. The message that we could send if we were leading a reconstruction effort in Afghanistan is, yes, we came in and did all those military things, but then we turned around and took responsibility for being a leader, and we helped to rebuild this country, not, again, for our own purposes, except insofar as we want it to be a stable place. And we send the message of the U.S. as a helper rather than a destroyer. I think we're going to make a huge mistake if we don't do that.
Larry Goodson is the author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. He's an associate professor of international studies at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Larry Goodson, author of Afghanistan's Endless War. He's an associate professor of international studies at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts. Four Afghanistan factions are meeting in Bonn, Germany, working out plans for a post-Taliban government. One of the challenges in forming a new government is representing the different ethnic groups within the country. Why does Afghanistan have so many different ethnic groups? Does it have to do with the way the country's borders were created?
In part, it has to do with the fact that Afghanistan, although it's existed as an entity for centuries and as a state known as Afghanistan, at least since the mid-1700s, but its modern borders were finalized in the 1890s when Afghanistan was perceived to be a buffer state between the Russian Empire, which was expansive at that time, and the British Empire in India, which was trying to sort of hold the line. And, for example, when you look at a map of Afghanistan, you see that long finger of land, the so-called Wakhan Corridor, that reaches out to touch China in just about the most mountainous place in the world. So it's a completely, in a sense, worthless piece of land. It runs through very high mountainous terrain. But it was drawn that way so that the Russian and the British borders would never actually touch. I mean, those days, a century ago, Russian and British. Now, of course, these independent countries that are there. And yes, some of the borders, like the so-called Durand Line, which is the Pakistani-Afghan border, which Afghanistan still has never completely accepted. It was drawn right through the middle of Pashtun territory. And so you have about half of the world's Pashtuns living on the Afghan side and about half living on the Pakistani side of the border.
How did the different ethnic groups get along when there was a king in Afghanistan?
Well, differently at different times, but if we go back 100 years ago to the period when Abdurrahman exercised internal imperialism, as the scholars have labeled it, to forge a stronger state in Afghanistan, we basically see that he used his own army, which he managed to transform into a national army and sort of Pashtun hegemony within the state, to crack down on the ethnic groups in very hard ways. There was a lot of executing and a lot of what we might now call ethnic cleansing, at least insofar as displacing populations and moving them around to different parts of the country. Forcible conversion of the Nuristanis to Islam and so on, all to basically pull these ethnic groups into being more closely controlled by the government in Kabul than they were used to, and this was, of course, resisted, and we saw various elements of this resistance at different points in the 20th century, especially during the revolt in the 1920s of Bacha Sikau, which was a sort of Tajik brigand or warlord who temporarily wrested power in Kabul from the royal family. And so there has been this history of real animosity, but at the same time, there's also been, I think, a more significant history of the groups getting along on a daily basis with each other. There is some intermarriage between different groups. That's not uncommon. They're traditionally, most of the groups have been able to get along. They identify themselves separately in terms of their different ethnicity or even their sub-tribe or clan status, but they still manage to get along reasonably well in large measure because, as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, the government's not that strong. And so the government often sort of left the groups to rule themselves. And since for most of Afghanistan's history, the country being so rugged and so underdeveloped, there hasn't been the means to get around very well, most of the groups didn't have that much contact with each other.
Are there any ethnic groups that are particularly discriminated against by other ethnic groups in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. The Hazara, the Shia Muslims of Mongol extraction who live in the central part of Afghanistan, have always been the second-class citizens of the country, and they don't really, I think, intend to be that in a post-Taliban, post-war reconstructed Afghanistan. But they were always treated with sort of contempt and given the worst jobs and so on during the period of Pashtun dominance during most of the 20th century. And a lot of the other ethnic groups also had the sort of adopted that same attitude towards the Hazara. And you can see some of that in the ethnic cleansing that has gone on in the last several years, where Hazara especially have been targeted by the Taliban when their areas were overrun or in just the ebb and flow of fighting in the areas that they control.
My guest is Larry Goodson, author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Goodson. He's the author of the new book, Afghanistan's Endless War. The region around Afghanistan includes the republics that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, like Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and each of those republics border Afghanistan. They have reserves of oil and natural gas. How do you think that's affecting the global interest in the area?
Well, Western oil and gas exploration deals have been struck in the past, and there is some interest in bringing, there has been for some time, interest in bringing a gas pipeline down through western Afghanistan out of Turkmenistan and into Pakistan. I don't see that as a motivating factor, obviously, in light of the events of September 11th for this military action, but it certainly is probably could be a positive byproduct from the point of view of those companies and perhaps from the point of view of Western governments of a more stable Afghanistan in the future.
The U.S. and Russia are more united than they've been in a very long time over the war against terrorism. But when this phase is over, do you think that there'll be a lot of competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for oil rights in the region around Afghanistan?
Absolutely. Russia wants the gas and oil to flow northward into or through Russian-controlled or Russian-influenced territory. And I suspect that we will want it to flow southward into what I anticipate will be a Pakistan that we're going to have closer relations, or at least that we intend to have closer relations with for the near future. And Afghanistan has no real economic base other than sort of subsistence agriculture. And so it's always been what Barnett Rubin calls a rentier state. And it could benefit by having the transfer payments for the passage of gas or oil through its territory. So I think that there will be a conflict of interest here, and I know it's being portrayed as a humanitarian move, but it strikes me as somewhat ominous that the Russians have been the first ones in to set up their embassy in Kabul, or the first major power, and to clear away the rubble and get a functioning embassy on the ground again, while the U.S. still dithers about whether or not we're going to reopen the embassy there.
And you think that relates to oil?
It relates to their intention to be the power that dominates on the ground in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
All of these regional countries, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, to mention the major players, to a lesser extent, Saudi Arabia, Uzbekistan, India, they all have reasons for meddling in Afghanistan. Some have to do with the various ethnic factions, but a lot of it has to do with the geopolitics of who will be dominant, the so-called new great game. And I think that a lot of that does grow out of the race for the oil and gas and mineral wealth that is perceived to exist in Central Asia and the markets that they hope will eventually be there out of the wealth that those minerals will create for the region. And certainly Russia intends to Russia sees this area historically as its sphere of influence and intends to be the dominant player on the ground, in my opinion.
You've been studying Afghanistan for about 15 years. What first drew you to it?
Probably the sense of this being a really exotic, romantic place, reading too many Kipling stories as a youth, perhaps, a place that where the people had a great nobility, where they were renowned for being hard, but at the same time warm and welcoming to visitors and foreigners, which they are, and the good fortune to study with Louis Dupuis, the great scholar of Afghanistan in the West, who helped me get a fellowship and helped me get out there and gave me so much wonderful advice about how to study and how to interact with the population. So all of those things together.
Does it sadden you to see what's happened to the country since you first started studying it?
It's enormously saddening. And it's one of the reasons why this interview has been so difficult, because because I've been so frustrated at recent decisions that seem to suggest to me that we are once again going to do our business in Afghanistan and then abandon it to its fate.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
Larry Goodson is the author of the book Afghanistan's Endless War. He's an associate professor of international studies at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts.